This episode of Country Squire Radio is brought to you by Missouri Meerschaum and ThisPipeLife.com. We thank them for their support of this show, and we thank you for supporting them.
You're listening to Country Squire Radio.
Welcome to Country Squire Radio. I'm Bo.
And I'm John Davis.
JD!
Hey, Bo. Good evening, man.
Man, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. I just pulled back in from the beach, and so I'm quite toasty.
Yeah, I was. You got this glowing, yeah, I think they call that a sunburn?
It's called a sunburn.
That's right.
There's just enough Scotch-Irish in me for me to, one, number one, be drunk, and number two... be really sensitive to massive amounts of sun. So yeah, dude, had a great time. Went to Perdido Key, which is just south of Pensacola in Florida, and had a really good time. Went to the Floribama, drank a few Bushwhackers. It's a bar on the line. It's on the state line.
Really?
Florida and Alabama. It's called the Floribama.
How have I never heard about this?
And I don't know, it's been in some country songs. I don't know. I know you're a big country fan, but they had this signature drink there called a Bushwhacker, which is basically, if you've ever had a Frosty from Wendy's, but maybe you mix it with like rum. Like that's what a Bushwhacker is.
I don't know that I like the sound of that.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. My traveling companion didn't care for it as much as I did, but it was you know, after a couple, you don't taste really anything at all.
No. The John David, this is true. The John David cold drink of choice, of course, you got the Boodles. But if Boodles is not an option, whatever has the most sugar in it, he typically runs towards.
The Bushwhacker, you know, it's substituted finally.
Well, good, man. You know, we were just talking about it. This last past month, I've been like on the road like crazy. Of course, I mentioned this past episode, we did kind of a dedication to my uncle who passed away.
And that's right,
dude. The man embodied New Orleans. I just want to share this real quick because I think it's kind of real special. The man was a devout Catholic, so we were having a funeral mass,
right.
But as a lover of New Orleans, at the end of the funeral, per his request, in the middle of this big Catholic church, this brass band starts playing. We do a New Orleans style funeral line into basically a party that was essentially like a wedding reception, because the man also loved weddings. And I got to tell you, it was when that band started playing, I both laughed and cried incredibly hard because it was so perfect.
Yeah.
Such a perfect way to send off somebody who meant so much to me. That's
great, man.
You know, we're sitting here and we actually are about to do kind of two dedications in a row here because, you know, the pipe industry itself has kind of had a significant loss here.
Yeah, I think this happened today, but Stephen Books passed away today from a long battle with cancer. We've mentioned Stephen before. Stephen is one of the probably most famed brick and mortar tobacconists out there that was left. Certainly a giant in the 20th century, and his shop, the House of Calabash in Oregon, is frankly just legendary. You know, you can read reviews of his tobaccos, and literally this guy was, you know, had blended for decades. I think almost if not at least 60 years, maybe over 60 years. I mean, we're talking like a literal lifetime of legacy when it comes to tobacco blending. And he's one of these people that I had never had the opportunity to meet him, but he's one of these people I always heard when you did interact with him. You know, he would recall blends that he, you know, had made in like the 70s or the 60s, and he could actually go back and pull out some. He's like, maybe I still got some of that back there, kind of thing. And remembered what he was thinking when it went into it. He was always pushing the envelope too. Things like deer tongue, and we mentioned before, rose petals, tea leaves, all kinds of interesting things that he would introduce into the tobaccos just to give it some different interesting flavors. And so, just a real giant, particularly for, you know, brick and mortar tobacconists. One of those places, the House of Calabash, was just a bucket list tobacconist for a lot of folks. His daughter Ava is actually carrying this on, and so she's been blending for Stephen as he's battled with cancer and stuff like that. So a lot of their top blends, their favorite blends, are still available. She's going to keep blending. Has been obviously well trained over her lifetime, but we just want to honor the the House of Calabash, Stephen Books, he truly is a giant in the pipe tobacco blending world, you know, certainly in the United States. And man, we just we honor you and salute you and appreciate all the stuff that Stephen did in his incredible career.
Absolutely, so, yeah. Man. Well, hey, joining us tonight, by the way, for the first time as we broadcast live here, shout out to Dr. Allen.
First time live listener.
Oh, that's great. In Ontario, Canada.
Yeah.
And
fantastic.
As the Canadians say, hello.
Do they say that?
I think they just say hello. I think that's right, but I'm not 100% sure.
Eh? Yeah.
We love that you're here and we
that's,
appreciate
it.
Man,
that's great. Yeah. Thanks for hopping on.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we also have some big news coming up, big events happening here in the pipe world, and actually
right.
getting kind of quick up here.
Yep.
And of course I'm talking about the Texas Pipe Show.
That's right. That's right.
So
October 7th coming up real soon. Not quite a month away, but man, we are so excited. We definitely want to mention a few things regarding the Texas Pipe Show. Of course, if you're anywhere within driving distance, this is certainly going to be worth your effort to come. They're going to have pipe carvers and vendors from all over, which will be a lot of fun. You'll be exposed to well-known folks in the industry. Different companies will be there. I know Lane and Scandinavian Tobacco Group will be present, so you have the opportunity to try a bunch of their tobaccos. But one of the centerpieces of this event, which we're so excited about, is, of course, the Slow Smoke competition. Mm-hmm. And Country Squire Radio and the Country Squire, we're really proud to be a sponsor of the Slow Smoke competition there. And just want to let you know, you can actually sign up for that at their website. Their
you
website
need to go ahead and make
and
that
you
happen.
Need you need to sign up ahead of time is kind of what they're requesting here.
Okay.
So go to texaspipeshow.com. Our friends that have organized the Texas Pipe Show have done a great job with this website, all the promotions. It's just real clean and super easy to navigate website. But if you go to texaspipeshow.com, at the very top you'll see Slow Smoke competition, and you can actually sign up for that online. And so, man, we're just so excited to be a part of that and to see that thrive. And I'm eager to see how that'll go. So,
and I'll say this too: I'll be competing, and I'm going to throw this out there. Whoever gets out right before and right after me, if you are out right out before or right after me, I want to get you on mic. You don't have to if you're mic shy, but if you ever wanted your chance to come on Country Squire Radio, we'll do a quick onset
that
interview.
That could be fun. Yeah,
I think so.
The person you vanquished and the person who vanquished you.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Exactly.
I like that.
And just so you know, I am merciful in my victory. I just asked John David Cole, who
that's
I have
bullcrap.
Absolutely destroyed in the only time that we ever competed. So I'm very merciful in victory.
One of these, I'll never live that down. The only way I'll live that down is if I come back at some point and beat you.
You're not even gonna compete.
But
you're
the thing
scared.
Is, I'm too scared, so I won't try. That's the problem with it. That's the problem with it. I'm even terrified. I'm literally making the blend for the Slow Smoke competition. I literally will have the
home
opportunity
field advantage.
To make the leaves to my advantage, and I still am too terrified to do it. But I know you are not. Man. If you're listening, and if you're on your way to the Texas Pipe Show, be sure to get on there and sign up. Also, as we all know, particularly in America, in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, which has just destroyed so much of the Texas coast, Houston, Corpus Christi, other towns, just all throughout that area, Beaumont, those communities have just been really destroyed. So what the Texas Show is doing, they've actually taken a lot of their the raffle stuff that they're going to be doing, and the proceeds for that is actually going to go to Texas charities to help with that relief effort. And so we applaud them for that. We really hope that y'all participate in that. There's a lot of folks that have donated items for that kind of thing. What's really cool, and this is just so amazing, it shows the tight, knit pipe community that we're a part of, but folks in the pipe smoking community have actually been sending care packages to folks in Houston and the surrounding communities,
right,
because
on.
a lot of these people, you've connected maybe with people on your favorite online forum, maybe one of the online tobacco magazines or Facebook group or something like that.
Sure.
know people in Texas, and so a lot of folks have actually been sending care packages to these folks in Houston, and not just that, but actually actually pipe smoking care packages. A lot of folks in that part of the world actually
they lost their connections.
They actually lost all their collection. They lost their pipes. They lost their tobaccos. They lost literally everything. And so, you know, a lot of times when you're scraping and trying to get by, you know, maybe one of the last things on your mind is, oh, all my, you know, my hobby supplies or whatever. But you know, it brings back that sense of like connectedness and humanity. That one little provision of, man, this person sent me a pipe and some tobacco. Wow, that's just it's really precious. And so we want to give a shout out to everyone who's helped with that, and really commend the Texas Pipe Show for you know, kind of getting behind the effort to help folks in that part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, not to jump ahead, but of course, you know, we're doing a Heroes of the Bowl. But if you're actually doing that, if you're you know, given to these efforts to help support the people in Houston, and you know, even in our kind of little corner, donating your pipes or your tobacco to help replenish the sellers out there of those who are experiencing some real tragedy right now. You guys and gal, y'all are the heroes of the bowl.
You're the hero of the bowl.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Well, hey, we also, we've got some great things going on here in the local area as well.
That's right.
Of course, the Jackson Pipe Night, October 28th.
October 28th, that is right. We're going to have...
What can people expect at the Jackson Pipe Night?
You know, we've done this, this will be the fourth year in a row now, and so it's a lot of fun. Of course, we'll have a slow smoke competition here. Mm. The folks from all over the Southeast
Just
practice, right? we've got folks that will come from literally all over the Southeast and... come compete in the slow smoke. We'll have live music. We'll have lots of food, strong drinks, you know, and it should just be should be a lot of fun. But anyway, we always do the top three winners of the slow smoke competition win a brand new pipe. Those sponsors that have graciously donated these pipes will be announced very soon. And we've also almost got all three of those locked down, which are really great. So anyway, just really excited about it. October 28th here at the Country Squire in Jackson, Mississippi. We may or may not be, you know, doing some streaming or something. I don't know. We'll figure all that out.
I mean,
I know we've done some periscoping before and things like that. But
I think the last two to three, I've always streamed at least my my shame I put out there publicly. So
it's great.
I'm out of practice. So I'm hoping that Texas does warm me up for
it'll be good.
You know, what's going to happen here? Because you know, if I fail in Texas, I will be embarrassed in the pipe community broadly. But I'd rather do that than be embarrassed in the local pipe community. Because I can handle...
You have to actually deal with these people.
I can turn off Twitter. I can't turn off the Squire.
You have to come up here, right?
Exactly. So, you know, we'll see what ends up happening. But it should be a lot of fun, and we're looking forward to it. Well, hey, man, before we dive into tonight's topic, we've got to give some shout-outs to some new club members.
That's right, man. It's exciting.
International Pipe Club, of course, the Country Squire Radio International Pipe Club, now has two brand new members joining here at the Pilgrim level. Big shout out to Casey Reed. Yep. As well as Ian Lo. Actually, I don't know why I mispronounced Ian, considering the fact that
is Ian
Lo Chavo.
Lasciavo.
Lasciavo.
I had a fraternity brother with that exact same last name.
Is it Ian?
And I bet.
Did you go to college with Ian?
It is not Ian. But I, well, no.
Wait, what was your Greek? I was a
Phi Delta.
Ian, were you a Phi Delta?
I don't think he was a Phi Delta.
No, maybe
he
did. What happened in the Phi Delta he had to get on the run and change his name.
No, he did. A lot of us did. Have I told y'all the story? Have I got my name? Have I mentioned that on the radio show before?
You want to throw it out there?
I the first 18 years of my life, I went by Jonathan. The first 18 years of my life, everyone knew me as Jonathan. Like
Game changer.
My parents called me Jonathan. They, sometimes it's, you know, people would say John or something, but I was just Jonathan all through high school, middle school. It was just Jonathan.
Okay, and my entire world has been turned upside down.
All right, so flash forward, we're freshmen in college.
Uh huh.
And there were two Jonathan Coles in my pledge class in my fraternity.
Okay.
I can't believe I've never mentioned this on the air. So there are two Jonathan Coles in my fraternity. My name was Jonathan David, and the other guy's name was Jonathan Wayne. And they were not going to call him John Wayne. They were not going to call him John Wayne. And they eventually cut him anyway. He didn't make it.
So you took out John Wayne.
So I took out John Wayne. John David. Jonathan
the
became Jonathan
expands.
Became John David, and then took out John Wayne.
Oh snap!
And so John David just kind of stuck. And after a while, that's, you know, I after a couple of years, like I just began to think of myself as John David, and all my friends call me John David. And, you know, it, generally my mom calls me John David, and, you know, dad sometimes will call me John David. It's just, you know, I'm just John David now. And so, and that's how it's been since I was 18. And so, you know,
I didn't know you were getting the John David origin story.
Ian Lasciavo, you brought us to that. You brought us to that. We thank you for joining the club. And now because of, our walk down memory lane with probably not you, but someone with a similar name as you. That now now everyone knows why I have the name that I
went. I had to read in my college dormitory. So Casey,
you had to read?
No, I can't read. That's really.
We've established that. For literally 4 years now, we've established that on Country Squire Radio.
Absolutely, guys. Thank y'all so much for supporting us, joining the club.
Casey and Ian, we appreciate it a bunch.
And hey, if you've not done so already, head over to CountrySquireRadio.com. There's a big banner that says "Join the Club" right there for all the details. It's a great way to help support the creation of the show. You get some good digital goods. Also, you get access to the Club Lounge as well, the Facebook Lounge as well, and which is my favorite online Facebook group that I'm a part of.
No, right?
Y'all are awesome over there. So anyway, join the club, be part of the community, yep. Help grow the show, just like Casey and Ian, and thank you guys so much for doing it. All right, man, we have got a...
This will be a fun episode.
This is interesting. So we're doing a Heroes of the Bowl, as we alluded to earlier in the show. And Heroes of the Bowl is a series that we do whenever we talk about pipe smokers of history and or fiction. And typically the way that we actually do this is we take a significant pipe smoker from history as well as a significant pipe smoker from fiction, and we kind of pair them up. You do history, I do fiction. Now, on occasion, we will have somebody that walks the line, if you will, to be so much involved in both history and fiction that they kind of deserve their own episode. And that is definitely the case of the pipe smoker that we're talking about today, the hero of the bowl that we're talking about today. And of course, I'm talking about the legendary Walt Disney.
Walt Disney. That's right. That's right. Just an American cultural icon, you know, a semi-inventor of an entire industry.
He imagineered the term imagineering.
Did he really?
I don't know. That might have been somebody else from inside the company. But
he certainly imagineered the term Epcot. That's, right?
That's true,
which
man.
We still don't know what it means. Actually, we do, and we'll get to that later.
Well, and so that's the thing. Before we even attempt to discuss, to dive into this discussion, there we got to put out a couple of precursors, just kind of the cliff notes, the notification, the asterisk, if you will. And that's to point out that we've actually talked about the impact of Disney as in terms of the company itself in some previous episodes. We actually did the dichotomy of Disney.
Yeah, that's right.
Talking about kind of the love-hate relationship that has been the history of Disney when it comes
with
to
tobacco products and pipes and cigars and all that.
Pipes, cigars, the premium products that are out there. And of course, you know, Walt Disney played into that to some extent. And in that series, we actually had our podcasting brother slash nemesis slash Obi-Wan Kenobi, the man, the legend, the
professor.
Yeah, I mean, the one that you if you know of us, you know of him. We're talking, of course, about Brian Austin Green. That was last.
Brian Austin Green Levine.
The other guy that married Megan Fox. Now we're talking about Brian Levine.
That's right. That's right, man.
That's who we're talking
about. Of course, Brian is the expert in the tobacco and Disney, you know, amalgam. I mean, he is where the two meet.
Exactly.
He really is. And so, you know, we're going to talk about Walt Disney tonight, but we really encourage you to check out a lot of Brian's resources. We are so grateful he was, you know, came on our show. Gosh, I guess it's been a couple of years ago now to talk about, Disney and just, the incredible connections there. Brian, I love this, and you can actually see photos of some of his collection online, but Brian actually has over the years collected Disney tobacchiana. I mean, Disney stuff that, he actually procured at, collected from people that bought these Disney items, tobacco products at the theme parks. You know, it's really interesting. They used to be tobacco shops workshops at the Disney theme parks, which is really kind of fascinating. So anyway, Brian, you know, this is kind of a shout out to you. We you know, definitely we'll cede the expertness in your corner.
We acknowledge we're walking around in daddy's shoes. You know what I mean?
We know
what's up. So
I'm sure a short joke is going to come out of the fact that you just said acknowledge walk around in daddy's shoes.
Yeah, no, I would.
But with Brian, we just assume that.
All right, so Walt Disney himself.
Walt Disney, that's right. Born in 1901, a pioneer, obviously, of the animation industry. A lot of folks, you know, we're so used to Disney now. And I think, you know, for me anyway, you know, looking into this and we've talked about Disney before, I always forget just kind of how prolific and long-lasting this Disney stuff is. Like, we're talking about Disney and people think Mickey Mouse, Dumbo, you go to the park and you wait too long in the line. That's kind of what you think about. But we're talking about currently the second largest media empire in the world.
Yeah.
Right after Comcast. And no one likes Comcast. So I'm just saying, like, you know, we're talking about a man, an individual that, you know, was doing things in the early 20th century. We're talking, he got his start as an animator at age 18. This was before 1920.
Yeah.
Okay. And then continued on to build, you know, the media empire that we know today. And so we think, okay, you know, we equate it with, you know, Donald Duck and Goofy and, you know, all these other stuff.
Yeah, the classics.
The Cinderella Castle and all this.
Yeah.
But it is so much more than that. And all that springs from who Disney was as an individual. He was an amazing person.
That's exactly true. And I mean, it's important to kind of separate that going in, because a lot of people, I say a lot of people, there's different camps when it comes to looking at Disney as in the organization.
Yeah.
You know, there are super fans of Disney. You know, just in the Disney podcasting world alone, there is tons of podcasts dedicated to every single aspect of that company, and there's significant fan base there. There's also people that look at it as kind of this evil, you know, corporate structure.
Disney owns ABC, they own ESPN.
Exactly.
I mean,
they've bought up all your childhood and all this other stuff. And you know, the other factor too is that you know, even very recently in some of their recent acquisitions, of course, now they own Marvel, now they own Star Wars. I mean, they have grown to this kind of massive thing now. That being said, I also think that the company has done some really great things
with
both Marvel and Star Wars. So, you know, you look at some of the practices of, you know, other, you know, CEOs or COOs of the company, and you kind of see some dirty business that has happened. We're not talking about that per se. We're talking about the man that
we're talking about, the man and the legend himself.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly. And so, you know, at the same time, he was not a perfect man. Of course, he held stances that we would not necessarily endorse, but you cannot deny the genius behind creating, you know, the early days of what Disney has become today.
That's right. That's right. Walt Disney, of course, you know, early 20th century, he got his start actually in the professional drawing industry before age 20. So even at age 18, he was hired to be an illustrator. And you got to think, okay, an illustrator, you know, in the 1910s.
That's,
I mean,
old
that's just
school.
That is crazy, man. Like, I mean, who? What are you illustrating at that point? Like the back of a the back of a milk carton? I mean, you know, it's just amazing. So, in his early 20s, he, you know, obviously very precocious, very young person, but extremely smart and ambitious. He moved with his brother to California and opened Disney Brothers Studio in 1923, which we now know, of course, as the Walt Disney Corporation, or the Walt Disney Company. So his brother Roy Disney, they were partners. Eventually, you know, Walt Disney, I don't really know the family dynamic there, but Walt Disney kind of became more the driving force there and was the larger personality. You know, but they just began cranking out these incredible pieces. You know, over the years you had Mickey Mouse in 1928, and then it went from there to Snow White in 1937, Fantasia and Pinocchio in 1940, Dumbo in 1941, Bambi in 1942. And I think this is kind of gets to what I was talking about or trying to get to earlier. When we think of Disney, we think of, you know, we think of the here and now, because all that's here and now. Like our kids today grow up with Mickey Mouse.
Oh, yeah.
Our kids today grow up with Donald Duck and Goofy and all these other characters. And of course, we did, Bo. And so we don't think of it as being that that ancient. But I mean, he got started, you know, Mickey Mouse was, his first appearance was in the Steamboat Willie in 1928.
That's right.
I mean, which it's incredible. Well, think of that's over 85 years ago.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Interesting kind of fun factoid, of course, people who are kind of interested in Disney and the origin story of Mickey Mouse will recognize the name of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit.
That's right. It's kind of the precursor.
He was
right?
The precursor, and he was a character that Disney and fam came up with. However, they came up with it while they were working for Universal. So Universal came in and be like, we own this. And so Disney was like, well, I'm not down with that. I want to be able to own the characters that I create. And so that led to the creation of Mickey Mouse. And it's one of these things that if you line these two characters up, other than the ears, there's not a whole lot different.
There's not a lot.
In the early days.
Absolutely.
And this is before, you know, you talk about that Steamboat Willie cartoon. That was really the first time that, you know, obviously Mickey Mouse had his debut, but the character hadn't necessarily had a personality develop. And one of the things that you actually see over a lot of his characters, Goofy, Donald, Minnie, they all over the course of several iterations were reimagined with different personalities. You know, the Mickey Mouse that we know today would seem a little bit different from the Mickey Mouse of, you know, the Steamboat Willie.
Of course,
era.
Yeah, absolutely. Even physically, these characters have evolved quite a bit.
You know what? Something I did not realize until we started doing some research for this episode.
You about to talk about the gloves?
Well, no, not the gloves. Although that is interesting.
That's interesting.
But no, it's the tail. It's that you know, somewhere along the way, Mickey Mouse has lost his tail, and I don't think I ever even noticed.
I never even thought about that.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Because in the original cartoons, in the earlier cartoons, he always had his tail.
He lost his tail, and he got gloves.
He got
maybe
gloves.
Maybe he hides his tail in his gloves.
Well, I mean,
maybe
I
he made his gloves out of his tail.
I would imagine the pants that probably tucked in there. I mean, yeah, the cartoon anatomy is kind of weird as it is, but... But no,
I don't even they have four fingers. I don't get it.
It's the weirdest thing, but I never really thought about the fact that, you know, in the modern era, you really don't even see Mickey Mouse's tail.
That's interesting. I've never made that connection.
Another fun factoid, you know who the first voice actor to portray Mickey Mouse was?
Was it Walt Disney?
It was Walt Disney.
He did it himself.
He did it himself, yeah.
Just amazing. He was such a pioneer of these different animation, conventions, I guess. And so was always going to what he thought would be the most, most accepted down the road and all that kind of thing. And so, he was just very, very ambitious, always pushing the envelope with animation. And I think that's why you saw his empire just increase so rapidly there. Really amazing. He, you know, go ahead.
Well, I just, you know, the big differentiator, you know, not only was Mickey such a, you know, just you instantly attached to him, and even Walt would go on to kind of describe the fact that, you know, a mouse is something that you know, universally you can kind of root for because it's this small creature that everybody is scared of, despite the fact that they are so meek and tiny.
Yeah.
But really what it was that set him apart is the fact that when Steamboat Willie came out in the Mickey Mouse cartoons, they introduced sound into the listening or into the viewing experience.
So that was actually a part of the advance there. Was
absolutely.
Just the introduction of sound itself.
Yeah, in much the same way that you think of like what Star Wars did for special effects.
Sure.
Or even like, you know, Avatar, which I've never actually seen, but
right.
You know, the way that kind of incorporated 3D. Like the technology of audio was so instrumental into the building up of what made Mickey Mouse so special.
That's crazy.
He was special on his own, but the fact that was there was really what kind of drove everybody to stop what they were doing, go to the theaters, and experience this new form of animation with actually audio attached to it.
Yeah, of course, Disney himself had the vision behind that. Mm-hmm. It's just incredible to see all the firsts that he kind of came out with. He eventually kind of developed a little crew around him. He was such a guru in this animation stuff that he developed what came to be known as his nine old men, which I love. And he referred to him as the nine old men.
It's
great. But the nine old men, you go look them up. You know, these were animators that wound up, you know, they were typically a little younger than he was, but these were all people that he as time went on, he leaned on more and more and began to take over real serious roles and kind of helping him develop and craft some of these storylines. And so these were the animators of the golden era of animation. Okay.
Man,
so
yeah.
Walt Disney and these nine guys, it's really interesting too. If you look back, there's neat stories of how modern day animators can all trace their family lineage back through those people to Walt Disney. And so it's kind of like, you know, I hate to, I don't want to be irreverent, but, you know, to go there potentially, you've got, you know, Disney, his disciples, and then they kind of they kind of filter that through to this greater mass, and a lot of the best animators in the world today can in some way trace their lineage back because of that.
They
That's
defined
right.
the industry.
They really did.
And actually, you know, you can find, you know, several, and I, you know, we are going to talk about pipe usage and all that kind of stuff, but it's just fascinating because you can actually look to those early days of Disney animation and how things were reused. And I think I remember this as a kid, even like, you know, seeing the way that like Baloo the bear would move and reminded me of Little John from the Robin Hood. You remember Robin Hood's a fox?
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of sequences where it's the same bear. Like, it's just straight up the same bear because they were reusing those early cells.
Even reusing the cell.
Animated.
Yeah.
And so that's why, you know, you think about how long it took, you know, before the, you know, the computer era, right? Before we actually had the computing power that we have today and you know, how... You know, with no disrespect to any animators or illustrators that are, you know, in the industry today, but
sure.
I mean, if you compare what they had to work with then, it took forever. So some of the techniques that they would use to be able to recreate and recycle and make sure that nothing got wasted,
right.
was, I mean, it's fantastic.
They're really remarkable.
They define the industry.
Yeah, really remarkable. As Disney got older, of course, he began to turn more and more of the creative stuff over to these nine old men. And so a lot of these guys actually wound up running in their own right the Disney Empire, which is interesting. Disney began to have this kind of obsession with the theme park model, with this model of like, okay, we're gonna build a holistic experience where you don't just see it on TV, you go experience it, you're gonna dwell within it. It's not a shop you go to, it's literally surrounding you. And so you know, in 1955, that's when Disneyland opened, of course, Disneyland in Anaheim, California. He tried really hard to make the experience at Disneyland be very self-encompassing, inclusive. It was just all, you never had to leave. It was one big experience that you could spend a whole day at. And so, you know, just to show you some of the success, you know, they had 3.5 million guests in their first year.
Oh, snap.
And you've got to think, this is 1955, okay? Like, like, I mean, 3.5 million guests And, you know, we're talking about just, you know, this is something, you know, it wasn't easy to travel at that point from New York to California, particularly if you, you know, didn't make, you know, just tons of money. And
right.
You know, I mean, that's a big deal kind of going forward. He became, you know, kind of regretful, though, about how, you know, Disneyland, you know, was... laid out. There were things that he wanted to change. He really
didn't own the property around.
He didn't own the property.
He increased the property value for the entire surrounding area of Disneyland.
Exactly.
And you know, that's the other thing. He was a creator, an inventor, a genius. He was a businessman.
And he was an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. He had increased the value for all this property around him that he didn't get a chance to.
But he didn't get to see the benefits and the revenue of that. And so. It really shows you as Disney began to turn more of the creative stuff over to these nine old men, he began to focus more, okay, how do we take this storyline, how do we take this all-encompassing thing and really turn it into a cash cow? I mean, just to be honest. And he was very, very, you know, shrewd at this. So what's so cool, when he wound up developing Disney World, what we now know as Walt Disney World, this kind of venture started, or at least became a idea, in the late 1950s, and then somewhere around 1960, Disney, I just love this story. There's been whole entire books. There's written on this, classes on real estate, you know, taught about this, all this kind of stuff. But Disney set up all these shell corporations, okay? and they were all you know, named in different names and things like that. I mean, random stuff, like, you know, the Port Authority of this, or the, you know, Exclusive Development Company of Nicaragua, or what. I mean, it was just all this weird stuff that had literally no, you know, no association with the idea of Disney, or, you know, any of that at all.
No Mickey Mouse.
No Mickey Mouse at all. And so, you know, and he, under these shell corporations, he started buying all this land in Central Florida. It's just so amazing to me to think about, the brilliance of that. And so with these dummy corporations, he bought all this central land, land in Central Florida. To hide his intentions. That way he was able to keep the prices really, really low
right.
of the land. So,
if they knew Disney World was coming.
Yeah, I mean, at that point. And so eventually what's fascinating about the story is, you know, Disney, he was incredibly self-conscious person. And a lot of folks think, you know, we'll talk about his tobacco usage in a minute, but a lot of folks think that the self-consciousness, the nervousness that he had, as much of a person as he portrayed of strength and peace and contentment and all these other things, he was a very nervous person, and so a lot of folks think that kind of contributed to some of this tobacco usage. But over the years he as he was building up all these different plots of land, kind of the word started to get out. The word started, something was going on. The local papers started realizing these plots of land were being bought next to each other. They were different sizes by different companies, but something had to be going on. A lot of folks actually thought maybe because NASA was so close in eastern Florida at Cape Canaveral that maybe it was something developing there to support NASA. You know, they knew something, though, was really beginning to happen there. And so finally, in 1965, Disney kind of let his cards be known, and he came out and mentioned that his Florida project, the Walt Disney World, was coming about. And so his idea with Disney World is not exactly what it came to eventually be. He wanted Disney World to be a theme park. He wanted it to include theme parks, but he saw it more as a, and this is where the idea of Epcot comes from. Epcot actually stands for Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow.
Yeah,
that's crazy. But that was, you know, that is, as you know, kind of stilted as that is, like that is what his central concept for this development was. He wanted Disney World to be a place where, yeah, you go visit and you do rides and you interact with, you know, Mickey Mouse and your favorite characters, and you know, you stay on the property and you buy food on the property and all this stuff, like you do that. But he wanted it to almost be like an incubator for the technology of tomorrow. He wanted people living on site, working on site in a community where they were pushing the envelope of daily living experience. Kind of think of it as it really like an incubator of tomorrow's technology. Okay, and so he had this grandiose idea of, you know, this is Disney World potentially is going to be, you know, the development leader, almost like a university research center for, you know, tomorrow's living and working kind of environment. And and right as he was formalizing these plans and finalizing some of that, he died. Died in 1966. And so, he was really the only person that probably could have spearheaded something like that. And so, you know, after he passed away, a lot, you know, the folks that took over the development, including his brother Roy, they just kind of torpedoed a lot of those plans. It was just a little too aggressive. And so what we know today is Disney World, of course, is the largest theme park on Earth. And you know, it does have this Epcot, but it's much more of a museum-like experience than a place where people live on site and are doing all this stuff. Having said that, you know, they do on site at Disney World grow a lot of their own food, use a lot of hydroponic technology. And, it's really interesting.
It's
if you've never been, you need to go.
And we, you know, the great thing is, you know, you talk about kind of his vision for tomorrow. There was actually a ride, and this is true of a lot of different rides there. There's actually a ride called the Carousel of Progress, and the goal of this was to kind of
communicate
technology over the era. And this kind of, you know, gets to the mindset of Walt Disney. You know, he's often photographed with a pipe in his hand. You know, he was definitely a fan of tobacco, but not just the pipe. He also kind of dabbled pretty hard into some elements of the tobacco realm that we would not necessarily...
That we discourage, typically.
Yeah, we would frown upon, but...
That's right.
But he was definitely a fan of the pipe as well. And so, you know, and you saw that actually in a lot of the exhibits, animatronics.
That's
right. You talk about his the way that he was pushing forth technology. You know, a lot of what was done in robotics and animatronics and recording kind of human movement went into the development for this particular ride of Carousel of Tomorrow. The host of that ride was this animatronic father figure. And so it was him and his family throughout the ages as technology would progress, but always He was holding a pipe.
He was holding a pipe. That's right. Absolutely. That's right.
And you did kind of get the sense that it was Walt Disney. In fact, there's a great video that you can find of Walt Disney walking you through the Carousel of Progress, in which he's showcasing this technology they've developed to be able to record human movement.
Yeah.
And he says, and he offers the animatronic a light to light up his pipe. And then right before he actually lights the pipe, he's like, oh, well, we're on set. We probably shouldn't smoke on set. It's a nice little moment. Also, you know, I mentioned that, you know, we were relatively recently in Disneyland a couple weeks ago. And one of the things that I noticed is, you know, you would actually see, like, for example, in the Main Street USA, if you go into the fire department, the firefighters obviously had a pipe collection. The pipes are unfortunately no longer there, but their pipe stands are still there.
That's interesting. Yeah.
They've got a whole carousel pipe stand that's there with an ashtray and everything else. And, you know, you can see the remnants of what was, in the early days, a very kind of strong pipe and cigar presence.
That's right.
One of the things we mentioned as part of the dichotomy of Disney is the fact that in Disneyland, and I believe Disney World as well, you actually had pipe and cigar shops. You could get branded Disney, Walt Disney pipes, branded Walt Disney cigars. You know, our friend Brian Levine actually gifted me, I meant to bring it tonight, but he gifted me an old Walt Disney cigar box, you know, branded and everything.
These are branded. I mean, these are cigars that have Mickey Mouse on the cigar.
Right.
Like, it's wonderful. It's like, you know, you could go on Main Street there in Disneyland and go to the local tobacconist. You know, they modeled these little businesses out of, you know, middle America, United States, you know, just small town stuff. And of course, you know, you had your general store and you had your tobacco shop. And so you could go get an ounce of Disney World pipe tobacco.
Absolutely. And, you know, in some of the rides, you do actually still see pipes kind of play into it. Pirates of the Caribbean, there's some pipe smoking pirates that are there. You know, even after the overhaul they recently did with the Johnny Depp films to try to get them more in line. I got to tell you though, I went to Classic Pirates of the Caribbean and I went to the new one. I like it classic better.
You like the classic?
Yeah, it just seems too gimmicky with the Johnny Depp thing. Like everybody, like every single segment, like we're trying to find Jack Sparrow. It's like, well, you weren't. Like, you know, like it's, I don't know. It just feels a little too cheesy, and then he like pops up at the end, and I don't want to spoil the ride, I guess, but he's just like sitting there with a crown and all this gold, and then it's just Johnny Depp that's talking to you, and you just kind of feel like you're taken out of the whole entire experience a little bit.
So out of control.
Yeah, but it was cool to see. I was like, all right, yeah, cool. We do still have some pipe smoking robots at Disneyland.
That's right. That's right.
That makes me happy.
Well, all that to say, you know, Walt Disney, of course, one of the most famous pipe smokers of the 20th century, one of the most famous humans of the 20th century, you know, someone that, you know, we don't know a lot about his pipe smoking. He was obviously, as you alluded to before, a very prolific cigarette smoker. He, you know, was constantly with this nervous energy turning to cigarettes. But the pipe was part of his experience. There's old anecdotes of some of his co-workers and employees kind of messing with his pipe tobacco while he was sitting around. If he wasn't looking, maybe they'd put some pencil shavings or something in his pipe tobacco just to kind of mess with him a little bit. But, you know, there's just always something, though, around Walt Disney that, of course, you identify with him as a pipe smoker and certainly as a creative. And so, just a fascinating figure, someone not only as a pipe smoker in himself, but also, as you mentioned, Bo, someone that incorporated a lot of these you know, these images and visuals of, you know, cigars and pipes throughout his, you know, characters. And so we owe a lot to him, you know, in kind of the history of pipe smoking in the 20th century.
You know, there's almost kind of a debate as to where, you know, there's a lot of people that would say that, you know, Walt Disney would be rolling in his grave to know that, you know, Disneyland and Disney World have kind of backtracked on kind of featuring pipes and cigars and such.
Sure.
There's also a camp that kind of looks at some of the work coming out of Disney near his final days and kind of wonders, you know, was he actually struggling with actually addiction? You know, one of the things we love pipes, we love pipe tobacco. We do a podcast about it and have a lot of passion for it. But you know, one thing we, you know, obviously would frown upon is giving yourself over to anything.
That's right.
And so, you know, you look at, you know, some of the things, like, for example, there was this 1951 cartoon that was put out. Yeah, 1951 cartoon. It was a goofy cartoon, and I don't mean goofy as in quote goofy, but goofy as in the character.
Yeah, the character Goofy.
Yeah, and it was kind of this no smoking campaign that they put out, and it was interesting because throughout that whole the narrative that's being told in that short is of Goofy, who is addicted to smoking. And so he's constantly, like, he's got his cigars and his pipes, but it's the cigarettes that are just constantly absolutely destroying him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you almost kind of wonder, like, you know, was this something that perhaps Walt Disney was wrestling with? Had he completely given himself over to this, which is tragic if that's the case. We don't know. To some extent,
right.
It is a debate that kind of goes on into.
He was very private about that kind
absolutely,
of stuff too.
Yeah.
He was a very private person. You know, he certainly had a different constitution, character of what he presented to the world. But then behind the scenes, you know, he was very private. So anyway, we know in some ways a little about him. But we do know that he did contribute a lot to our culture and
big time,
and obviously it deserves a Heroes of the Bowl episode.
Well, you know who else contributes a lot to our culture?
Missouri Meerschaum.
The good folks at Missouri Meerschaum.
That's exactly right.
Man, we've got a pipe that is sponsoring this show this week from Missouri Meerschaum. Corncob pipe. What do you call this little thing?
That dude is the shortstop.
The shortstop.
I love the shortstop.
Because I was about to call it the little devil, but that's not right, because
that's another pipe.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
we encourage you to check that one out, too. But the shortstop at Missouri Meerschaum, what they've done here, and when I first saw this pipe, I fell in love with it. It is a small frame pipe, and what they did is they took the bowl of the Missouri Meerschaum mini pipe. It's the same bowl that the pipe has.
Okay.
But they put a much longer shank on
they
the
turned
pipe.
It into a real pipe.
Right. they took the bowl of the mini pipe and they actually put a much longer shank on that pipe. And it just turns it into this great little kind of pocket billiard corncob pipe. It's a wonderful pipe. So very incredibly light, a small bowl, but a much longer shank in order to make the smoke just a little more comfortable, a little cooler, and it's a more practical pipe than the miniature pipe as well.
You know, we talk all the time about corncob pipes, Missouri Meerschaum pipes, and how it's great. You've got to have some corncobs as part of your toolkit, you know, for when you're sampling tobaccos, that sort of thing. I mean, the beautiful thing about this one, this little shortstop, this is great for in a pinch because it'll handle about a pinch of tobacco.
That's about it.
And so if you're out and about and you want to try something new, sample something new, or, you know, you don't know what you're getting into, man. This is you're exactly right. This is a perfect pocket pipe.
The bowl is literally big enough to put your tamper into, and that's about it.
That's about it.
So great pipe. Of course, what you would expect from the folks at Missouri Meerschaum. Comes in a couple different finishes, which they do very often. But check out all the Missouri Meerschaum pipes on their website, on our website, on any website. And if you do have a Missouri Meerschaum shortstop, we encourage you to take a photo of that. Take a photo of you smoking that pipe. We'll retweet that out, and would love to show to the world. So anyway.
Yeah. Big thanks to them for supporting the show.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Pipe question of the week.
Pipe question of the week this week comes in from Sean. All right, you ready for this?
Yeah.
All right, so he says, "Hey guys, it seems to me that the words sandblasted and rusticated sometimes get used interchangeably.
Yeah.
Are all sandblasted pipes considered rusticated? Are all rusticated pipes considered sandblasted? Between retailers and the wealth of knowledge available, there does not seem to be consistent rules that he can see. He wants to know, he would love to hear what Tobacco Jesus declares as truth. This is, of course, coming from
so awful
listener Sean. All right, so
so terrible.
Sean has come to you in his hour of need.
Yeah.
How shalt we know?
Shut up. What's the difference between rusticated and sandblasted?
Yes,
and,
yes.
And are these words interchangeable and you know all that? So yeah, these are different terms and for different processes of giving texture to a pipe. So a lot of times you will see. Savinelli's really bad about doing this. They'll list all their pipes that have texture and are not smooth as rustic. Sometimes other companies will do that as well. They'll say rustic pipes, or maybe they'll just say blast pipes. But typically, what the industry standard of this is that a rusticated pipe is one where texture has been applied to the pipe through some type of mechanical means. Okay, and so like you've got a pipe,
like the machine touches the pipe.
The machine actually touches the pipe.
Got it.
Right, and so you've got this pipe, and you know we're going to sit here and poke a bunch of little dots in it. Almost think of like and some carvers actually do this. Almost think of like using a Dremel tool or like a little burr tool to actually put little designs,
okay,
carvings in your pipe.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So that's what we refer to as rusticated pipes. Okay, rusticated pipes. The tool actually touches the pipe. A lot of times, think of the carver's knife kind of pulling out little chunks and decorative ways. There's different types of rustication. Some rustication is very very light, and so those divots or texture might be very small. Some rustication is very deep. Think of we talked about Costello not too long ago on Country Squire Radio, the Sea Rock Briar that Costello does. Those are rusticated pipes that just have this real authentic gnarly rustication where they've taken out huge chunks of the outside of the bowl, and so just real beautiful sandblasted pipes. And a lot of folks just this is not. It's just kind of lost on them because they don't really know, how this works or what the process entails. But sandblasted pipes, you're actually sandblasting.
You blast the sand out.
You're actually blasting the pipe. Yeah, you're actually blasting the pipe with some type of media. Now, this could be sand. A lot of times it's glass beads. It's small glass beads.
I mean, isn't sand glass beads anyway? Science?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Hashtag science. But yeah, you go Google that. That's a different episode on a different podcast. But yeah, so you've got a pipe that is basically put into a container. It's like kind of a cabinet where it's a sandblasting cabinet, and particles are blasted at this pipe or at the wood at a really high speed. And what that does, instead of mechanically the some kind of knife or tool touching the pipe, what sandblasting does is it allows those small particles to take off the softest pieces of the briar. Okay, and so you've got pipes that at this point now they're exposed to all the softest pieces have been removed, and so that's where you start to see these wavy looking things. A sandblast, you can always tell the difference because it's a wavy pipe. You've got these kind of ridges in the pipe that literally look like air was blown over the pipe, because it was.
It's pulling out this natural deep texture.
It's pulling out natural deep texture. It's not artificial in any way. It's really, really beautiful. And so, some folks prefer a rusticated pipe because they like something that is maybe more uniformly texturized. Some people like a sandblasted pipe because what sandblasting does is it allows the probably the most famous sandblasted pipe out there is the Dunhill Shell Briar. This is a pipe that at a very early age in its development, they just started kind of taking particles, blasting the very lighter, more weak parts of the briar off, and you're just left with these incredible waves of ring grain that just follow around this briar. And so each one's got their own preference, but they are different. They're different things. And so rusticated pipes again are going to be physically touched by a hand or a machine, and sandblasted pipes will be typically blasted with sand or glass. So
that's good.
Yeah.
Well, great, Sean. Thank you so much for asking that question, teacher. What must I do?
That's a good question.
To become rusticated.
Oh, shut up.
No, that's pretty good. We love that pipe question of the week. Hey, if you've got a pipe question of the week for us, send it in. show@countrysquireradio.com. Again, that is show@countrysquireradio.com.
Quick fire with the squire.
All right, man. These come in from thispipelife.com. Specifically, Jay Freedy. Freedy at thispipelife.com.
Jay Freedy, yeah.
Thispipelife.com. Hear more about them in a minute. All right, here we go.
Yep.
Middle Earth or Narnia?
Middle Earth. I love Narnia, though. I do love Narnia. I love the imagery. I love what, you know, Lewis was much more explicit with all his, you know, chronicle stuff about its tie towards spiritual realities. Lewis was much more explicit, where Tolkien was much more, it was certainly there. We all acknowledge that if you're a Tolkien, you know,
but
person.
It took Tolkien a while to
Tolkien was much more veiled about, about a lot of it. Yeah. And so, I love Lewis. I love just the, you know, the character of Aslan and, I don't know, just all that. If we're talking about childhood, what I, you know, preferred more, what I got into more, what I read more, I don't know. I have a place for Middle Earth.
Yeah, you know, it can be easy not to fully appreciate the fact that Narnia was so much more fantastic. Like magic. I mean, there's magic, obviously,
yeah,
in Middle
Earth. Yeah, sure.
But like the way that quote magic kind of plays into every aspect of Narnia, you know, and even just, you know, the benefits of like falling into Narnia because of it being out of time, you can go there, live your entire life, come back out, you're a kid again, you know, and then do it all over again. There's a lot of benefits to Narnia over Middle Earth from that standpoint. But yeah, Middle Earth is just so much more hardcore. You got to give it to Middle Earth. But you're right. Narnia is great.
For me, that's a tough decision, but I'm gonna have to go with Middle Earth.
All right, ESV or NAS? Talking about the English Standard.
Oh,
version.
Bible translations. New wow, this American is wow, this is interesting. This is becoming kind of a. I see the theme of this thread of questions. I'm gonna go with the ESV.
I'm
an ESV guy. I think it's a great. A great translation.
All right. No, yeah. I'm right with you on that one.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I was, you know, the ESV, I think, actually one of the main editors when the ESV, came forward as a translation, gosh, this is probably, 20 years ago or something, was J.I. Packer, one of my favorite preachers, and of course an Anglican priest, I have a lot of fondness for the ESV.
I'll
go with that.
I'm ESV as well, so very good. All right, physical Bible or Bible app?
I gotta go with the physical Bible. I gotta have something I can write in.
Okay, so.
I like you know, scribbling stuff.
Yeah, that's good. The problem with me is I'm so self-conscious about my writing anyway, because I'm going to misspell anything that I wrote. That I was never one to write notes. Like, I remember being like,
you don't write in your Bible anyway.
Yeah, I mean, like there was
like, someone's going to see this and I'll feel like an idiot.
The youth pastors were always kind of like, oh, you know, write in the margins. I'm like, I don't write. That's just not something that I do.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
So when I was able to get the Bible on my phone, because the other factor too, and I mean, some of our listeners may know this, maybe don't, but I'm dyslexic, and so it takes me a lot longer, you know, time to read. But what I found is the condensed nature of kind of like a screen viewing, as opposed to like all of these words like spread out over the page, kind of helps.
Gives
me
your eyes less time to wander or something.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And it makes it much, much easier experience there. And I mean, there's also just the convenience factor. And I think we finally come to a day and age, I don't know if this is universally true in churches all across America, but I think that we're at the point where now, if I get out my phone in the middle of, you know, in the middle of a sermon,
people probably know that you're looking at your Bible.
Exactly. The assumption
is also
that
you might be looking at Facebook.
Well, no, I'm not, because you know, a lot of churches have terrible reception in there and in the sanctuary.
That's right.
So, I think you can. So I'm all about the Bible app. All right, and then finally, a fly rod or spinning rod?
I'm not a fisherman. Everyone knows that. But if I had to pick between the two, it'd be a spinning rod, because I've actually used that.
Yeah. It's spinning rod is super easy. But no, fly rod all the way. Ever since I became a fly fisherman, it is my preference every single time I can get away with it. I'll go, you know, I go both ways. But I, I have preference for the fly rod.
That's great.
All right.
Good questions.
Great questions.
Interesting questions.
Jay Freed, he set us up, or she set us up with a significant list. So we've got some great ones set for next week as well. And of course, those are coming in from the forums at thispipelife.com. Now, if you've not joined thispipelife.com yet, you absolutely should. Thispipelife.com is the website. And when you sign up, use the code CSR to let them know you heard about him on this program. Now, it's absolutely free one way or the other. I don't want to try to convince you that it's not. But when you use that, it helps them know you heard about it here. It helps out the show, and it's like a quick pro quo for JD and Bo.
That's so lame.
But it rhymed.
Man, it's a great resource for people looking for just camaraderie in the pipe smoking community. You know, obviously any kind of help questions, things like that. We do quick fire questions through there, but there's a whole wealth of knowledge through thispipelife.com. Incredible forums, great social media. You can find them on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and we encourage you to check all of them out. So be sure to do that. When you join, enter the code CSR, and we thank them for supporting the show.
Your thoughts, your comments, listener feedback.
All right, listener feedback. All right, we got to address this. I'm just going to go ahead and knock this one out.
No, that's good.
The listener feedback has been coming in live and fast.
No, that's good.
Since the top of the show, and yes. You know, for the listeners at home, I am not wearing what is kind of perceived as, and intentionally so, perceived as my traditional getup. Typically, I have
dude, where's your hat?
Well, I typically wear a cap, I wear a baseball short, a shirt of some sort, be it a beard core short or a Podastory short.
Yeah.
Today, I have no cap, which means my hair looks like this, and I apologize. I know that I'm offended.
I think we're all disgusted, frankly.
No one more so than me. I have to look at this daily. At least twice a day, and it's rough. But no. So this is unfortunately what you're getting. As for the random shirt and why I'm not prepared, it's Labor Day. It's vacation.
That's it.
You know, my wife works in the healthcare industry, which means that you know, funny enough, people don't stop being sick or dying on days.
Yeah,
off.
That's true. That's true.
And so
nerve of those people.
I know. So she of course was at work, and I was taking care of my amazing children.
The little Bo Yorks.
Yeah. Yeah, and so this is what I look like after that. You're welcome.
And that's that. Also got other folks. Apparently, this is the second or third time we've mentioned how I got my name on Country Squire Radio, which is interesting. It's funny, Bo and I, we do this so much that we kind of forget some of this stuff.
Well, the thing is, I remember aspects of it because, I mean, you know, we've talked about
we're such good friends that maybe I've told you about it before or whatever.
We talked about the JD aspect of it and kind of diving into that. But I think it completely went over my head, the fact that you went so long as Jonathan.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah,
like when I just say that. Yeah, it just doesn't natural.
The majority of my life, I was Jonathan Cole.
Wow.
And now I'm not. And I much prefer John David, and have been John David for 15 years, something like that.
All right, John.
Anyway. What else do we have here, Bo?
We've also got, you know, last week we talked about the I may have given a little bit of flack to. You know, the real American hero, G.I. Joe.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, suffice to say, there was some debate that continued on Facebook and Twitter after the fact, and I realized I had an unpopular opinion, but I appreciate those of you who did. M80s and G.I. Joe toys made up the 90s, and it made it a great time for Hochter, a.k.a. the Love Doctor.
That's right.
He wanted to give that shout out there. We also have Tobin Pilati. Am I pronouncing that correct?
Probably not. But he says, great show. I am relatively new to pipe smoking, and I'm really geeking out on the whole pipe history and types of pipes, I'm assuming. So thanks for doing this show, Tobin. We appreciate you reaching out. Really hope you enjoy your pipe adventures and stick with it, man. I every time I hear of a new pipe smoker getting into it, my biggest encouragement is surround yourself with resources and stick with it. You're going to really enjoy it. Don't get frustrated. Stick with it. Find some tobaccos that you really enjoy, and it'll bless your heart. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, man, look, talking about tonight, we Walt Disney. I mean, like, I almost kind of feel like that was a Hero of the Bowl we probably should have done a while back.
A long time ago.
I guess to some extent
maybe we have. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's something we've talked about him before just because of the, you know, prolific nature of his influence on American culture. But, I don't know. He deserved his own episode. We gave it to him.
Hey, one last thing before we officially sign out here. Next week... We will not have a live show. We're throwing you off because, I mean, here we are on a holiday and we did a live show. But next week we actually will not have a live show as John David will be globe hopping. But we will have a special co-host. Some call him Caleb. The rest of us call him Intern.
The Intern.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
so,
right.
So I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm excited about this.
I have a direction that I hope the show goes in, but we won't know until it happens. but that's the thing. When they're interns, you don't necessarily feel comfortable putting them on the webcam yet, you know?
Yeah, you know, you got to put the training wheels on, right?
What would happen? He might show up looking like I look like now. I can get away with this because we've been doing this for years. But like, you know, young guns got to work.
You got to earn his stripes.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So anyway, all that to say, next week, no live show, but we will, of course, have the podcast coming your way on Wednesday.
That's right.
And so we hope that you enjoy the one that we have scheduled for you coming up here next week. But that not being the case, after that, we will be back to the regularly scheduled program. That's, of course, Monday nights, where you can tune in live at countrysquireradio.com. And, of course, you can tune in every single Monday night, not next week, but after that on 8:30 Central, 6:30 Pacific, 9:30 Eastern. You can also keep up with us throughout the week. You can follow me. I'm at The Real Bo York.
I'm at John David Cole, or you can get us at the shop @_CountrySquire.
Of course, all that information and more can be found at CountrySquireRadio.com. Well, there it is, man.
Dude, it was great. And we're already getting people tweeting in pictures of Shortstop Missouri Meerschaum pipes.
Yeah, look at Russ Hicks.
Isn't that
putting
wonderful?
That out there.
Yeah, dude, it's one of the best pipes out there.
Smoking a little Green Dragon in it. He's doing good. Green Dragon for the Country Squire. That's what we're... I mean, it's Green Dragon.
We love it.
Yeah, that's
it's great. It's Green Dragon. I mean, you know, it's just no telling what's in that.
All right, man. Wayne, let's go have a night.
See you, brother.
Been listening to Country Squire Radio, a member of the Podastery Network. For more information on this and other shows, please visit podastery.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.